another 91, in July, another 83, and so on through the year. In Belarusia from June onward, hardly a week went by without wrecking and espionage being discovered in various industrial enterprises, the Academy of Sciences, the Polish Theater, the physical culture groups, the banks, the cement industry, the veterinary services, the bread supply organization, and the railways. The local railway authorities were denounced on October 8, 1937 and charged with being not only Polish but also Japanese spies, in accordance with railway tradition. In Central Asia, it was the same. 25 executions were announced in Kazakhstan, and 18 in Uzbekistan in November. In January 1938 came 26 in Kyrgyzstan and another 134 in Uzbekistan. On July 28, 1937, E.G. Yevdokimov assembled the party leadership of the North Caucasus territory and gave instructions for a long-planned super purge in the area. On 31st of July, the local phase of this general operation was launched in the Chechen Ingush Republic in the North Caucasus. 5,000 prisoners were crammed into the NKVD prisons in Grozny, 5,000 in the main garage of the Grozny Oil Trust, and thousands of others in various requisitioned buildings. In the republic as a whole, about 14,000 were arrested, amounting to about 3% of the population. Shkiryatov in person oversaw a further mass operation in October. The cold-blooded administrative organization of such mass arrest and deportation comes out very clearly in Serov's order number 001233 for the Baltic states. Operations shall be begun at daybreak. Upon entering the home of the person to be deported, the senior member of the operative group shall assemble the entire family of the deportee in one room. In view of the fact that a large number of deportees must be arrested and distributed in special camps and that their families must proceed to special settlements in distant regions, it is essential that the operations of removal of both the members of the deportee's family and its head shall be carried out simultaneously, without notifying them of the separation confronting them. Arrest. Whether as part of such a special operation, or in the ordinary course of routine arrests, it was usual to take action in the small hours. Two or three NKVD men, sometimes brutal, sometimes formally correct, would knock and enter. A search was made which might be brief but could take hours, especially when books and documents had to be examined. The victim, and his wife if he had one, sat under guard meanwhile, until finally he was taken off. A quick-witted wife might in the long run save his life by getting him some warm clothes. By dawn, he would usually have been through the formalities and be in his cell. A general describes his arrest. At 2 in the morning there was a knock on the door of my hotel room. "Who's there?" I called. A woman's voice answered, "A telegram for you." Obviously from my wife, I thought as I opened the door. Three uniformed men came into my room and one of them told me point blank that I was under arrest. A poet writes of his, also at night. "Go with you," you ask, looking for your coat, your arm fumbles for the sleeve. You feel overcome by a sudden weakness, in such a moment you tire as in a lifetime. It seems a ravine has opened under your feet, and the ceiling seems to fall on you. There is suddenly not enough air in the room. You breathe with an effort. The new constitution, indeed, had guarantees against unjustified arrest. Under its Article 127, no one might be arrested except by order of a court or with the consent of the prosecutor. This was anyhow not of much value in the absence of an independent judiciary, and the judicature of the USSR was officially defined as a means of strengthening the socialist regime, guarding the rights of citizens and repressing the enemies of the people and the Trotskyite, Bukharinist agents of foreign espionage organizations. But in any case, a distinction was made between arrest and detention. A man might be detained without the sanction of the court or prosecutor in all cases where public order and security is threatened. Moreover, Article 45 of the Corrective Labor Codex reads, "For reception into a place of deprivation of freedom it is obligatory to have a sentence or an order by organs legally empowered thereunto, or an open warrant." In fact, a prosecutor's warrant seems generally to have been provided, though sometimes formalities were dispensed with. For example, a case is reported from the Ukraine in which the police arrested two chance visitors for whom they had no warrant together with the man they were after. Each of the two accidentally arrested spent 5 months in jail before managing to get out. Cases of mistaken identity, particularly of persons with common names like Ivanov, are also occasionally noted. Such prisoners were usually released after a few weeks or months, but cases are mentioned of their having confessed to espionage or other crimes before the mistake was discovered. Even then, they were sometimes released. Copyright releases were most exceptional in 1937 and 1938. One prisoner had incurred a 5-year sentence for wondering why an old actress, Ekaterina Korchagina Alexandrovskaya, had been nominated for the Supreme Soviet in the autumn of 1937, when a number of harmless cultural figures were so used to improve the governmental image. He was condemned for speaking against a candidate of the communist and non-party bloc. A friend, Lev Rosgon, got him to tell his wife to approach the actress herself, who went to the NKVD and complained. They told her that the offender had been jailed as a spy for the British and Japanese, and showed her thick files supposedly containing the evidence and sentence. However, he was able to send his real sentence, still in his possession, to be shown to Korchagina. 3 weeks later, he was released. There are many accounts of the NKVD insisting that anyone released, usually after 1938, should sign a guarantee not to reveal what had happened to him in jail. A Soviet newspaper recently quoted one such. I, Sternin, N. V., pledge never and nowhere to speak of what became known to me between June 11, 1938 and July 11, 1939 about the work of the organs of the NKVD. It is known to me that on any breach of this I will be accountable under the strictest revolutionary laws, for divulging state secrets. Wives were not told where the arrested had been taken. The method of finding where they were was to go from prison to prison. In Moscow, wives would go to the information center opposite the Lubyanka, at 24 Kuznetsky Most, then to the Sokolnicka, then to the Taganka, then to the office of the Butyrka, in its small courtyard, then to the Lefortovo military prison, and back again. When the head of the queue of hundreds of women was reached, an official was asked to accept the 50 rubles a month to which as yet unconvicted prisoners were entitled. Sometimes a prison administration, perhaps through bureaucratic incompetence, would not admit that it held the man in question until the second or third time round. One Moscow wife found a girl aged about 10 in front of her in the queue with a dirty little wad of ruble notes. She was paying it in her for father and mother, both arrested. Anna Akhmatova's son, the young Orientalist Lev Gumilyov, was in jail in Leningrad. During the frightful years of the Azov terror, the poet says in the foreword to Requiem, I spent 17 months in prison queues in Leningrad. One day someone recognized me. A woman with blue lips standing behind me, who had of course never heard my name, suddenly woke out of the benumbed condition in which we all found ourselves at that time and whispered into my ear, there everyone spoke in a whisper. Could you describe even this? And I said, I can. Then something resembling a smile flickered over what once had been her face. Akhmatova speaks of her own mouth as one through which 100 million people cry, and asks that if a monument to her is ever put up, it should be at the prison gates in Leningrad where she stood for 300 hours. In 1940, she was allowed to see her son, and afterward wrote the poem which is number 9 in Requiem, feeling that she was going mad. Young Gumilyov was again, or still, in jail in 1956 when Fadayev made an appeal to the prosecutor's office, saying that although he was only a child of 9 when his father was no more, he, as the son of N. Gumilyov and of A. Akhmatova, was at all times a convenient target for career-seeking and hostile elements who sought to make accusations against him. This makes it clear that he was, like so many others, the victim of his relationships. Women who actively tried to get their husbands released almost never succeeded. One typically describes being called to a local NKVD headquarters at midnight and simply being told, I order you to stop running about like a lunatic trying to get your husband released. I order you to stop bothering us. That's all. Get out. After a husband had been sentenced, it was again difficult to trace him. One method was to write to the addresses of camps of whose existence a woman had heard from other wives. Sometimes, after a wife received a long series of printed forms saying that her husband was not at such and such a camp, he could be found and, in certain types of sentence, parcels accepted. For the wives, indeed, life was very bad. General Gorbatov remarks, I often thought of my wife. She was worse off than me. I was, after all, in the company of other outcasts, whereas she was among free people among whom there might be many who would shun her as the wife of an enemy of the people. And all reports agree that the women lost their jobs, their rooms, and their permits, had to sell possessions, and had to live on occasional work or on the few relatives who might help them. Ignorant of their husband's fate, they faced a worsening future. To the cells. The arrested man first was taken to a reception point in one of the prisons, signed in, and submitted to a strict physical search and an examination of his clothes seam by seam. Bootlaces and metal attachments, including buttons, were removed. These searches were made at intervals during imprisonment. At the same time, thorough cell searches were carried out about once a fortnight. In the cells, while there were variations around the country, the prisoner would find much the same routine: intense overcrowding, inadequate food, boredom, and squalor, between bouts of interrogation. Life in the Tsarist prisons is universally described as very considerably preferable to those now developed. In particular, there had not been the overcrowding. A prisoner who had been in Moscow's Butyrka prison in 1933 says that while in that year there had already been 72 men in a 24-man cell, there were no fewer than 140 in November 1937. Degree in a woman's cell supposed to hold 25, 110 women were crowded. Planks covered the entire floor and the few beds, apart from a small part of the central gangway, a table and two large latrine buckets. It was impossible for the prisoners to lie on their backs, and when lying on their sides, if one wanted to turn over, it could only be done by negotiating with the prisoners on either side to do it all together. The cell in which Pugachev had been held alone before his execution was now occupied by 65 people. Most of our descriptions of prisons are those in Moscow, Leningrad, or the Ukrainian capital. The impression given is scarcely a favorable one, in the Shpilenv, a four-man cell held up to 40. But conditions seem to have been a good deal better there than in the provincial jails. Several accounts remark on prisoners from Chelyabinsk or Sverdlovsk, on arrival in the packed cells of the Butyrka, exclaiming that the place seemed a holiday camp compared with their previous experiences. A civilian official describes being shown around Pervoralsk jail, "The stench struck me like a physical blow. Where the overflow was too great, as in some of the Siberian towns, vast pits were sometimes dug and roofed over, and the prisoners simply herded in." By the autumn of 1937, a Kharkov prison built for about 800 held about 12,000.2 in Novosibirsk. About 270 men were crammed into a 40-square-meter cell. In the most crowded cells, conditions were literally lethal. In a letter in a recent issue of a Soviet newspaper, a survivor describes an 8-man cell in Zhytomyr prison into which 160 men had been crowded. They had to stand up, pressed tightly against one another. Five or six died every day. The bodies continued to stand up because there was no room to fall down. Overcrowding was treated differently in Moscow than in the provinces. In Moscow, space was gained by having the prisoners sleep under the beds and on boards between the beds. By this means, it was possible to accommodate up to three men to the square yard. In provincial prisons, beds and boards were taken out to make room for more inmates. In some, as we have seen, people slept in rows, lying on their sides, but when cells were even more crowded, half the occupants had to stand while the other half slept, packed, on the floor. Each cell elected its starosta, or cell leader, who was responsible for keeping order, allocating sleeping places, and so forth. The new prisoner was put next to the reeking slop bucket, or parasha, getting better places as his seniority increased. In the morning, a short time was given for ablution and excretion. For example, 110 women in one cell were allowed 40 minutes with 5 lavatories and 10 water taps. In prisons in the big cities, at least before they became too crowded, prisoners were taken to the baths every 10 days. Sufficient soap was issued. Clothing was regularly disinfected. In most of the provincial prisons, however, conditions were already filthy. During the Yezhovshchina, the usual daily ration was 500 to 600 grams of black bread, 20 grams of sugar, and thin cabbage soup twice a day. In some prisons, there was also a tablespoonful of groats and hot water 3 times a day. In the Butyrka, alternate days saw cabbage soup and fish soup, about a pound of black bread, and a meal of lentils, barley, or groats in the evening. This is described by a woman prisoner as being worse than what she was managing on in town after losing her husband and her son, but, even so, good in comparison with what she was to get in the camps. These rations were usually delivered regularly and fully. Prison diet seems to have been calculated to be just enough to keep a more or less motionless prisoner alive. It was unhealthy fare. But the general conditions were more unhealthy. Prisoners showed a peculiar grayish-blue tinge from long confinement without light or air. The main diseases resulting were dysentery, scurvy, scabies, pneumonia, and heart attack. Gingivitis was universal. But the prison administration was held strictly responsible for the actual life of every prisoner. This was taken to such paradoxical lengths that in the same cell you would find prisoners suffering severely from the effects of interrogation about which nobody bothered, while every conceivable medicine for the prevention and cure of colds, coughs and headaches were regularly distributed. Equals and great precautions were taken against suicide. Doctors reluctant to interfere with the course of the interrogation would sometimes treat prisoners whose ribs had been broken under a different diagnosis, but giving them the right treatment. Medical conduct in a provincial prison is reported as being in a different spirit, the examination being conducted quite openly with a view to seeing how much the prisoner could stand. A certificate issued was quite frank about the beatings and was evidently entered in the official records without a qualm. This was in early 1938. The company, apart from a plague of stool pigeons, was usually good, especially in Moscow, and innumerable cases are given of kindness and self-sacrifice, as when, a Hungarian communist reports, a prisoner, back from even worse conditions, was allowed a bed to himself for a whole day by the 275 men crammed into a 25-man cell, and was given extra sugar. From their rations, lectures were given on a large variety of subjects, and much storytelling was also done. Herling mentions too that every cell contains at least one statistician, a scientific investigator of prison life, engrossed day and night in assembling a complicated jigsaw of the stories, scraps of conversation overheard in corridors, old newspapers found in the latrine, administrative orders, movement of vehicles in the courtyards, and even the sound of advancing and receding footsteps in front of the gate. All prisoners report cases of party officials who remained loyal, and held either that Stalin and the Politburo knew nothing of what was happening or, alternatively, that they themselves were not qualified to judge these decisions, and simply had the duty of obeying party orders, including confession. There were other types. In one of the cells of the Butyrka, there were the sons of five moderately important officials. Four of them were the typical brutalized product of the new privileged youth of Stalinism. They had freely denounced their parents and boasted of it, taking the view that there was no reason why they should harm their own prospects to look after relics of the past. Only the fifth, the son of General Gorbachev, the executed daredevil, was a decent youth. Smoking was permitted. All games were forbidden. Chess was, however, played illegally, with men made out of bread or other objects. In one of the women's cells in the Butyrka, a fortune-telling game with matches was played. When a wardress saw people with matches, she would count them, and if there were exactly the number required for the game, 41, the owner was punished. Books are reported as available in two Moscow prisons, the Lubyanka and the Butyrka, though at the height of Yazhov's power, they seem to have been prohibited. These libraries were good, containing the classics, translations, histories, and scientific works, sounding much better than those of British prisons or, indeed, hospitals or cruise liners. The Butyrka's was particularly fine. The reason was that it had been used for political prisoners in Tsarist times, and the big liberal publishing houses had always given free copies of their books to these jails. Tilde that of the Lubyanka was largely of books confiscated from prisoners. After Yazhov's appointment, new and harsher regulations came into force. All windows were blocked with shutters, still called Yazhov muzzles, which left only a small piece of sky visible. They had, indeed, been in use in the Lubyanka, and the equivalent Shpalnery prison in Leningrad, for some years. After the Bukharin trial, as a reprisal, these panes were shut except for 10 minutes a day. Bread became moldy, clothes damp, and walls green, joints ached as though some creature were gnawing them. The penalty for the slightest offense, such as the possession of a needle, was the punishment cells with only from one-half to two-thirds of the already small prison ration, deprivation of outer clothing, and permission to lie down only at night, and then on the stone floor. Punishment cells had, logically enough, to be even worse than ordinary ones. A Soviet writer mentions three grades of them in Yaroslavl in 1937. In one there was light, and the prisoner kept his or her clothes. The next was a moldy hole in the wall, totally dark and cold, with only a vest permitted and bread and water once a day. She was in it for 5 days for the offense, in any case not committed by her, of writing her name in the washroom. From the remaining first category, which she escaped, people came out only to die. The trees and flowers which had grown in some prison yards were meanwhile cut down and the ground asphalted over. Zavalotsky, in his poem The Ivanovs, had spoken of trees standing, behind railings, under lock and key. He was himself to be deprived of the sight of even these. At the same time, as far as possible, the more liberal warders were liquidated, and only the least popular guards were retained, after re-indoctrination courses. Some prisoners, particularly those under interrogation in especially important cases, were kept in inner prisons. So were certain men already serving sentences. The regime in these inner prisons was quite different from the bullying squalor of the main buildings. Unlike the mass cells, with fetid air and prisoners pressed close together on bare boards, which nevertheless had a certain social life, of discussion and even occasional scientific and literary lectures from specialists, the inner prisons were living graves. The cells were clean, without overcrowding, each prisoner had his own bed and even linen, and clothes were actually washed once a month. But no noise, not even loud speech, was permitted. The spy hole in the cell door opened every few minutes. The prisoner had to be in bed from 11 p.m. to 6 o'clock a.m. during the day. He could sit down but not lean on anything. There was nothing whatever to do, on an adequate diet. Isolation was complete. Weisberg, in isolator cells in the Ukraine and then in Moscow, only learned about the outbreak of war at the end of October 1939. There were only a few hundred prisoners in an inner prison at a time when thousands and tens of thousands might be in the outer one. Such a prisoner had to undress in such a way that his hands could be seen and, when sleeping, to keep his arms outside the covers. Weisberg says that this was because a prisoner had once plaited a length of string under the cover and hanged himself with it. In any case, it would have been the only opportunity for making any illegal object. If a warder saw a prisoner's hands hidden, he would enter the cell and wake the prisoner each time he detected him. In the inner prisons proper, communication by tapping was almost impossible, and was seldom replied to as being probably the work of a provocateur. Elsewhere there was a certain amount of it. Registered the method is that described by Arthur Kessler in Darkness of Noon, the so-called Decabrist alphabet, dating from the prisoners of the 1820s. Trademark. In the isolation cells, the psychological problem was intense. A former actor from the Bolshoi Theater who had served 5 years gave the following lesson. First, you must detach yourself from reality, stop thinking of yourself as a prisoner. Make believe that you are a tourist who temporarily finds himself in an unfamiliar environment. Don't admit to yourself that conditions here are very bad, because they may get even worse, and you should be prepared for that. Don't become too involved in the everyday life of the isolator. Try not to hear its sounds, especially at night, or to smell its smells. Try not to be aware of the guards, don't look at them, ignore the expression on their faces. Stop making believe about the possibility of your being released soon from the isolator. Do not attempt to regain your freedom by means of a hunger strike, or by admitting your guilt, or by appealing for mercy to the authorities. Stop pining for the friends you have left behind in the free world. A special category of prison consisted of the half-dozen political isolators, notably those at Suzdal, Verkhny-Uralsk, Yaroslavl, and Alexandrovsk. These dated from earlier days of the regime, when they had been thought of as a comparatively humane method of removing factious communists and other left-wing politicals from public life. Even in the early 1930s, treatment in these prisons was comparatively humane. During the purge, they sank to the normal level. A Soviet commentator says of the food in the Yaroslavl isolator in 1937 that it contained no vitamins whatever. For breakfast we got bread, hot water, and 2 lumps of sugar. For dinner, soup and gruel cooked without any fat, and for supper, a kind of broth reeking of fish oil. But the isolators still preserved some special characteristics. They mostly held no more than 400 to 500 prisoners. Typically at Verkhny-Uralsk, there were cells holding either 10 to 25 or 3 to 8 prisoners, with in addition a number of solitary cells. It was usual for important prisoners serving sentences, but not expendable, in that further trials were planned for them, to be held in these, the great prisons. Of the 5 main prisons in Moscow, 3, the Lubyanka, the Lefortovo, and the Butyrka, were for politicals only, though they were also held in the other places of detention with non-politicals. The Lefortovo was the great torture center, though torture was also practiced on a lesser scale in the Lubyanka and in the special section of the Butyrka. The Lubyanka was free of bugs, and the same is reported of some of the Kiev prisons, though bugs usually abounded. In spite of the far cleaner and more sanitary conditions in the German concentration camps compared with the Soviet labor camps, the same does not seem to have been true of the prisons. The Berlin Central Prison on the Alexanderplatz is described as being more lice-ridden than prisons in Moscow. Trademark. The corridors of the Lubyanka were clean, smelling of carbolic and disinfectant. It is the best known of the NKVD prisons, since it lies within the headquarters of the police ministry, and has been the scene of the most famous imprisonments, interrogations, and executions. But though its great wedge looming over Dzerzhinsky Square is only a few minutes' walk from the Kremlin and the general tourist area, it is seldom pointed out to visitors even now. It was originally the headquarters of an insurance company. The Chica took over the old building, and over the years built over the entire block. The original building is pre-revolutionary Gothic, the rest of the block was rebuilt in 2 bursts, one in 1930 functional, and the other in post-war wedding cake style. The People's Commissariat consisted of the whole outer section. Inside is a courtyard, and within the courtyard is the 9-story prison section. This was originally a hotel or boarding house run by the insurance company, and though considerably adapted has not been rebuilt. As a result, the rooms used as cells are less unpleasant than the cells in the other prisons. The windows, though largely blocked by shutters, are of good size. The Lubyanka had about 110 cells, which were fairly small. It seems improbable that more than a few hundred prisoners were held there at a time. Prisoners who were unsatisfactory in the preliminary interrogations at the Lubyanka were often transferred to the 160-cell Lefortovo, in particular, the military. No clear account of the atrocities practiced in the Lefortovo is available. We are told that prisoners who had been there and were transferred to the Butyrka regarded the beating up in the latter prison as child's play compared with their previous sufferings. The Lefortovo was built just before the First World War in a more or less star shape, with blocks radiating from the center. It had the advantage that there were water closets actually in the cells. The Butyrka, started in the 18th century to house the captured rebels of the Pugachev insurrection, is by far the largest prison. It consists of a number of vast barrack-like blocks, centered on the old section, the Pugachev Tower, in which the great rebel had been held before his execution. In the purge, it held about 30,000 prisoners. Gorbatov, who was tortured in the Lefortovo, says that the Butyrka was an immense improvement. Prisoners got half an hour's exercise a day instead of 10 minutes every other day. It had large exercise yards, unlike the cramped squares of the Lefortovo. Exercise was taken, walking in pairs, with hands behind backs and eyes to the ground. Any swinging of arms or raising of heads was immediately stopped. Women with newborn babies are reported in the Butyrka. Tilda, on the other hand, others were brought in who had had to leave children, and nursing babies, unattended at home. They had their breasts bandaged to stop the milk. The Taganka, and other prisons holding politicals and others, were like the Butyrka, but dirtier and less efficient. A special small prison some 10 or 20 miles out of Moscow, the Sukhanovka, deserves mention. It had a particularly fearful reputation among prisoners, who knew it as the Dacha. It was a single-story building, consisting of a set of isolators, and torture was the normal method of procedure. It is said to have been built specially for the Rudzutak. Postyshev intake. It was the one place where the regulations were observed so strictly that the warders literally never spoke at all to the prisoners. In Leningrad, there was a similar system. The Shpilerny prison, described as comparatively clean and orderly, fulfilled the role of the Lubyanka in Moscow with about 300 cells. The larger Nizhnogorodsky, too, had a number of one-man cells for important prisoners. The Kresht, equivalent to the Butyrka, with about 30,000 prisoners, was more squalid altogether, with 16 men sharing what had been a one-man cell in Tsarist times. A special transfer prison held those already sentenced to camps. And outside, tourists were being shown as a horror of the past the cells of the old Peter Paul fortress, where a handful of politicals had been held in considerably better circumstances before the revolution. Whether in one of these or in prisons of various degrees of rigor, malnutrition, and overcrowding, the arrested citizen awaited the authorities' next move. As a general thing, physical conditions were usually far worse in the provincial jails in Minsk, Gomel, Vyatka, or Vologda, but regulations were less tightly enforced. There was more offhand brutality, but also more chance of a comparatively sympathetic warder, who might even warn against informers. As an experienced prisoner puts it, the dirtier the prison, the worse the food, the rougher and more undisciplined the guard, the less danger there was to life. Criminal types. In his cell in this new community, the arrested man might be interrogated at once, or he might wait for some time. Meanwhile, he would discover in discussion with his cellmates what his crime was likely to be. At the beginnings of the purge, those arrested often thought that the other people in the prisons were actually guilty of something, and that only their own case was a mistake. By 1937, the outside public had come to realize that the accused were innocent, and people brought in took it for granted that their cellmates were in the same boat as themselves. The chances of anyone there being actually guilty of anything whatever were very small. One sometimes hears the view still expressed in the West that the Great Purge, though unforgivably striking at many innocent men, at least destroyed, in passing, the genuine spy networks of hostile powers. Such was not the view of Gomułkow, who remarks that the terror only facilitated the work of the intelligence services of the imperialist states. In fact, from the purely intelligence point of view, the Japanese, Polish, and Latvian services at least seem to have gained all the information they required. And apart from direct operations, the mere fact of, for example, the defection, owing to fear for his life, of the Far East NKVD chief, Lushkov, to the Japanese in 1938 must have put them in possession of a veritable treasure house of information, and this defection was a direct result of the terror. There is one important earlier case generally recognized as that of a genuine spy, Konar, who became Assistant People's Commissar of Agriculture until accidentally exposed. He was a Polish agent who had been given the papers of a dead Red Army soldier in 1920, and in 10 years had thus risen high in the hierarchy, until exposed by someone who chanced to have seen the real Konar. As to minor agents, a number of books mention, as an extreme rarity, real spies or men who at least might possibly have been guilty. Tilda, there is one such, the Moldavian, in Solzhenitsyn's camp in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. In a Kiev prison in 1939, there was much pride and astonishment on all sides that one of the prisoners was a genuine Polish spy. Once he had admitted his own guilt, he was badly 118. Beaten to get him to implicate party officials in Kiev. Prisoners recognized, in most cases of arrest, that there was an objective characteristic basic to their cases. This might be social origins, past or present posts, relationships or friendships with someone, nationality or connection with a foreign country, or activity in specific Soviet organizations. This probable real cause of arrest was at once plain to sell. 119. Mates, though it was never mentioned by the interrogators. For although there were many categories, membership in which was liable to bring arrest, such as foreign connections, high military rank, and so forth, these were not the crimes officially charged. Nor did they automatically lead to arrest. We can even quote cases of German communists who were not arrested, although they were political refugees. Arrest depended on a variety of secondary factors. One peasant in Kharkiv jail accounted for his arrest by the fact that he had been arrested on a false charge 4 years previously, and released with apologies. This, he thought, must make the NKVD think that he had reason to dislike it. This was apparently not an unusual case. Hundreds of thousands of people were arrested during the purge for no other reason than at some time in the past the Soviet authorities had done them an injustice. To have had anything to do with foreigners was one almost certain road to arrest. People who had actually been abroad, for example, footballers like the three Staristin brothers, stars of the pre-war period, were almost all 122. In camps by the 1940s. In general, sport was thoroughly purged. Loathsome counter-revolutionary work at the Institute of Physical Culture led to the denunciation and arrest of the human degenerates concerned, who included I.I. Karchenko, head of the All-Union Committee on 123. Physical Culture and Sports Affairs. Philatelists were arrested en bloc, as 124. Were Esperantists, for their international connections. Professor Karl Monson, assistant director of the Moscow Zoo, had been educated abroad, so was assumed to be a spy by his cellmates. After his first interrogation, he triumphantly told them that he was only a wrecker minus 16% of his monkeys having died of tuberculosis, a lower figure, he pointed out, than the London Zoo's. But they were vindicated by his second interrogation, which reached the main question: espionage for Germany. Tilda, everyone connected with the organizations for contact with friends of the Soviet Union abroad was automatically suspect. These organizations sponsored pen pal exchanges. One young science student is mentioned as being sentenced as a German spy because he had, on this basis, been writing to a communist in Manchester, though his letters have consisted almost entirely of Soviet propaganda. All direct contact with foreign consulates was likely to prove fatal. Doctors who had treated German consuls, a veterinarian who had dealt with consular dogs, even more indirect connections, such as the veterinarian's son, were arrested in the Ukraine, and another man, an old caretaker, always explained in prison that he was there as the brother of the woman who supplied the German consul's milk. Another had copied and given to the Polish consul the weather forecast pinned up in the public park. An opera singer who had danced longer than permitted with the Japanese ambassador at an official ball is reported in camp. A cook had applied for a job advertised in Vechernaya Moskva, the evening paper. It turned out to be at the Japanese embassy. She got the job but was arrested for espionage. Before she had time to start it, registered another typical cases of two engineers and their families, arrested in the winter of 1937-1938 because of a gift parcel one of them had received from an uncle in Poland, consisting of two pairs of shoes, some crayons, and a couple of dolls. The engineer who had not 130. Received the parcel, but was a friend of the one who had, got 10 years. A Greek doctor was charged with espionage on the grounds that he had written to relatives in Salonika describing the characteristics of some fish. 131. Being bred with a view to the extermination of malarial mosquitoes. In December 1937, Greeks were arrested everywhere. Later, the Greek-inhabited area of Mariupol, on the Black Sea, was thoroughly purged in connection with a special Greek nationalist plot which was to create a greater Greek republic over a large part of the Ukraine. Its minister of education was in fact a Russian, but he had been professor of ancient Greek at Kharkiv University and had spent a year in Athens. The prime minister had been an advisor on minority questions to the Ukrainian. 132. Central Committee. Chinese were also arrested en bloc. One is reported as having been charged with taking a job as a tram driver in Kharkiv, with the aim of crashing it into any car on the tracks in front of him which contained members of the Soviet government. The national minorities in Russian towns were virtually eliminated. In September 1937, the Armenians in the Ukraine were rounded up. There were 600 of them in Kharkiv. The Latvians were arrested the same month. An alleged Latvian secret organization had worked for a Greater Latvia stretching over a large part of Russia, including Moscow. Members of the smaller national minorities were in as bourgeois, nationalist plotters. So were, in most cases, members of larger groups like the Ukrainians. One commented, "I was bound in any event to be regarded as a Ukrainian bourgeois nationalist. True, I had never had anything to do with Ukrainian nationalism, and had never had any sympathy with it, but I had a typically Ukrainian surname, and I had several sympathizers with Ukrainian nationalism among my acquaintances." It is an interesting fact that there were almost no accusations through the Great Purge of allegiance to any genuinely reactionary idea. Those accused were almost always linked with the Mensheviks, the Armenian Progressive Nationalist Ashinks, the Socialist Revolutionaries, or Communist Deviationist groups, practically never with monarchists, Cadets, and the like. The Jewish Social Democratic Bund was a particularly fatal association, and many Jews qualified for accusation as either Bundists or Zionists. A case is quoted of an elderly Jew who had worked as a defense lawyer in earlier trials in the Donetsk Basin and had conducted himself in a way that antagonized the NKVD, by asking it for documents which might be helpful to the defense and so forth. He had learned enough not to defend himself, and on his arrest signed everything that was put before him without reading it. He later found that he had installed himself as a leader of a Bund group, in touch with other counter-revolutionary organizations, including one headed by the provincial party secretary, Sarkisov, a candidate member of the Central Committee. On one occasion, he was told that he was going to be confronted by an important accomplice called Abram Schoen, of whom he had never heard. When this man was brought in, the investigator said, "Stop looking at each other as if you'd never met before," so he immediately remarked, "Hello, Abram Schoen." "Hello, the other started, having to be prompted with his chief's name. Then they both signed the records of their confessions about each other without looking at them. Genuine Bundists, on the contrary, are always reported as being the most refractory in interrogation, being better educated in Marxism than their interrogators, and toughened by a harder underground life in Tsarist times than that of the Bolsheviks. All former socialist revolutionaries were arrested. Weisberg tells of a man in Kharkiv jail who had joined the Bolsheviks in 1917, but who in 1905 had distributed among the Tsar's soldiers leaflets provided by the socialist revolutionaries. He had then been a young student and, far from being a member of the Party of Socialist Revolutionaries, did not even realize that there was any difference between it and the Bolsheviks. Almost all ex-Mensheviks were also arrested. We are told that in 1937, 1941, 97-98% of Russian socialists were physically annihilated. But everybody with unorthodox ideas of any sort was liable to end up in the camps. Jehovah's Witnesses were automatic victims. But there were also two enthusiastic members of legal religions, such as the Baptist mentioned by Solzhenitsyn. Tolstoyans are widely reported, including an aged Tolstoyan woman whose 12-year-old granddaughter had fought the NKVD officers to try to prevent her arrest. Priests had always had a difficult time under the Soviet regime. Now they became almost automatically suspect of capital crimes. Trials of priests were announced throughout the Union. One in Orel in the summer of 1937, involving a bishop, 12 priests, and others, had as one of the accusations publishing prayers in Old Slavonic. Other accusations were less credible. Three bishops sentenced in February 1938 had agitated for the opening of previously closed churches, but their further crimes included. 142. Sabotage. The main Soviet authority of the time mentions that Buddhists were commonly agents of Japan, engaged in sabotaging bridges and. 143. Farms. It was also true that the activity of the counter-revolutionary Muslim priesthood in the USSR is directed by the Japanese secret service. Many were accused of railway sabotage. One Tatar imam who had been allowed to visit Mecca was naturally suspect and was soon arrested as a German spy. A meeting of about 40 leading mullahs, in fact all under arrest, but acting as if it were a normal assembly, accepted the charges against him, and he was shot. The authorities also destroyed not a few nests of spies directed by holy Catholic priests who had been responsible for the sabotage of factories, bridges, and railways as well as. 147. Espionage. If it was neither nationality nor past nor ideas that brought a prisoner in, it might be relationship, the purge within the party, the government, and the army automatically spread in that way. Each of the accused had relatives, and acquaintances who also had relatives. We have already noted, here, the four categories sent by Ježov to Stalin of people to be shot, of which list four is the simple wives of enemies of the people. Equals we have seen the liquidation or imprisonment of the general's relatives. The military men had, it is true, been shot in comparative haste without public trial. Confessions in the longer drawn-out affairs were in part obtained by promises not to kill the surviving dependents. Stalin's promises were sometimes kept. A woman prisoner met in labor camps 12 wives, 2 daughters, 2 sisters, and a daughter-in-law of prominent purges. Registered 8 years was the usual sentence. Typical of purges of the second rank was Alpater, a commander of Stalin's bodyguard, Alet, who was arrested, together with his wife. She. 99-144. Refused to confess, but was finally confronted with her husband in a very bad state, who mumbled that she had said she would get rid of a picture of Stalin that hung in their new flat, formerly Yagoda's. For this, she got 8.150 years. The wives of the Soviet elite adjusted most slowly of all to their situation in the cells. Their position was an especially difficult one. They had nothing to confess and were unable even to deny the charge, since it was simply of being wives of enemies of the people. In many cases they had not, as their husbands had, understood the dangerous possibilities before them. On arriving in the cells, some of them were priggish and intolerant of women who had been under arrest for a long time, believing that these earlier cases must have been guilty of some genuine offense. Even when not arrested, families suffered terribly. An attempted mass suicide is reported by a group of 4 13 and 14-year-old children of executed NKVD officers, found badly wounded in the Prozorovsky Forest near Moscow. The daughter of an assistant chief of Red Army Intelligence, Alexander Karin, who was arrested and shot, with his wife, was 13 in the spring of 1937. The Karin apartment was taken by one of Yezhov's men, who turned her out into the street. She went to her father's best friend, Shpigelglas, assistant head of the Foreign Department of the NKVD, who put her up for the night, but was virtually ordered the next day, by Yezhov's secretary, to throw her out. Shpigelglas remembered she had relatives at Saratov and sent her there. 2 months later she came back, she was pale, thin, her eyes filled with bitterness. Nothing childish remained in her. She had meanwhile been made to speak at a meeting of the pioneers, approving the execution of her father and mother and saying that they had been spies. When Weisberg was in the sick bay of the Kharkov prison, there were a number of children there, including a boy who was 9 years old. When, early in 1939, the Soviet press started to report the arrest of various NKVD officers for extorting false confessions, one case at Leninsk-Kuznetsk in the Kiemrova province concerned children as young as 10 years old. 4 officers in the NKVD and the prosecutor's office received 5 to 10 year sentences. In all, 160 children, mainly between 12 and 14, had been arrested and subjected to severe interrogation, and had confessed to espionage, terror, treason, and links with the Gestapo. These confessions were obtained with comparative ease. A 10-year-old broke down after a single night-long interrogation, and admitted to membership in a fascist organization from the age of 7. Similar mass trials of children took place in various other cities. There is, indeed, one report of a genuine children's organization which planned to avenge arrested parents by killing the NKVD officers they held responsible, but, in general, as a Soviet speaker has pointed out, not only the workers themselves were victims of repression, but also their families, down to the absolutely innocent children, whose lives were thus broken from the beginning. Another category was composed of automatic suspects, anyone connected with production, and in particular engineers. In their case, no guesses were needed. They were saboteurs to a man. It did not matter if their record was generally good. Stalin himself had said, "No wrecker will go on wrecking all the time, if he does not wish to be exposed very rapidly. On the contrary, the real wrecker will show success in his work from time to time, for this is the only means of staying on the job, of worming himself into confidence, and continuing his wrecking." Activity. In the economy, the security mania of the NKVD seems to have been genuine. For quite apart from the persecution of actual people, It imposed by about the end of 1935 a system through which guards and watchmen multiplied enormously in the factories, research institutes, and so forth throughout the country. This was in part supposed to be for the prevention of theft, but also against the penetration of secrets, many of which were not secret even by Soviet standards and almost none of which would have been regarded as secret in any ordinary community. Moreover, there already existed in every Soviet institution a secret department, covering both the political reliability of personnel and the technical secrets, and into its safes anything remotely confidential had to be put each night. It is now stated that in 1939 there were, in a labor force of 78,811,000, no fewer than 2,126,000 guards and watchmen, not counting NKVD militia, and only 589,000 miners and 939,000 railwaymen. In this atmosphere, any failure, or any accident, in the economic sphere automatically became sabotage. In the absence of genuine opposition acts, any breakdown had to be made to serve, just as Molotov's accident at Prokopievsk had to be inflated into an assassination attempt in the absence of any genuine one. And already at the Pyatakov trial, railway accidents had been put to the account of the accused, with Vyshinsky graphically recounting the sufferings of the murdered passengers. In the Bukharin trial, livestock deaths were attributed to the conscious activities of the plotters. Sharangovich said in evidence, "In 1932 we took measures to spread plague among pigs, and later, speaking of horses, in 1936 we caused a wide outbreak of anemia." Sharangovich also mentions a number of particular plants, a cement works, a flax mill, a pipe foundry, a power station, in Belorussia, where he was first secretary, as having been sabotaged under his instructions. Failures in the grossly overextended first five-year plan were very widespread indeed. But even if the local first secretary was usually responsible, in every case subordinates were involved. On the economic side, Soviet statistical and planning methods led to an endless strain on skilled management. The planning figures were always unrealistic. To admit failure meant instant arrest, so the directors concealed it as best they could. This led to a vicious circle with doubly erroneous figures in the ensuing period. When the gap grew so large that it could not be concealed, a scapegoat had to be found, and then there is a crisis and the chief director and a number of officials are sent to camps, but those who take their place have to employ the same methods all over again. The 162 system as it stands leaves them no option. The directors who organized the new works faced appalling tasks. Lykachi, of the Stalin Automobile Works in Moscow, had to try to direct 25,000 men, with crises about administration, raw material, or simple negligence arising almost hourly. At the Gorky Works in Gorky, an even larger factory wore out the director, Diakonov, even before his arrest. The head of the automobile industry, Dybritz, and his assistant were arrested in 1938. In the same year, in the metallurgical factory in Sverdlovsk, the old Bolshevik director, Semen Magrilov, shot himself in his office, leaving a long letter attacking the terror. All those suspected of having read it were arrested and disappeared. By the beginning of 1940, this factory had 2 engineers and 31 technicians with the right qualifications, and 270 without. Magnitogorsk had 8 engineers and 16 technicians with diplomas, and 364 without. In general, as a Soviet legal journal tells us, hundreds of thousands with no qualifications now took over the engineering and 164. Technical work, with disastrous results. Production, stagnant in 1937 and 1938, actually went down in 1939. The railways were subjected to particularly draconian laws. The Criminal Codex of the RSFSR, in its Article 59, covered crimes against the system of government, including various offenses on the railways which lead, or might lead, to the breakdown of state transport plans and of which some examples given are the accumulation of empty trucks and the dispatch of trains off schedule. The prescribed punishment was up to 10 years or, if done with malicious intent, the death sentence. Kaganovich also devised the so-called theory of counter-revolutionary limit setting on output, with the help of which he organized the mass destruction of engineering and technical cadres. In a short period of time most of the directors of railroads and of the railroad's political departments and many executive officials of the central apparatus and lines were dismissed from their jobs and later arrested. As to sabotage itself, on the Soviet railways at this time there was an accident of some sort every 5 minutes. As we have seen in dealing with the Pyatakov trial, this led to the slaughter of the railway cadres. Kaganovich had made a tour of the railways of the Far East early in 1936. Following this, the military collegium went on tour and handed down 5 death sentences and 10 long jail terms in Krasnoyarsk and Tomsk in March, for wrecking for foreign intelligence services. This was only a beginning. In his speech at a meeting of railway activists on March 10, 1937, Kaganovich said, "I cannot name a single road or a single system where there has not been Trotskyite, Japanese sabotage. Not only that, there is not a single branch of railway transport in which these saboteurs have not turned up." Under Kaganovich, arrests of railway officials were made by lists. His deputies, nearly all road chiefs and political section chiefs, and other executive officials in transport were arrested without any grounds whatever. On August 10, 1937, Kaganovich wrote to the NKVD demanding the arrest of 10 responsible officials in the People's Commissariat of Transport. The only grounds were that he thought their behavior suspicious. They were arrested as spies and saboteurs and were shot. He wrote, in all, 32 personal letters to Yazhov, demanding the arrest of 83 transport 168 executives. The North Donetsk Railway was the only line not involved in these sweeping arrests of early 1937. In August, the heads of the line were called to Moscow and instructed to find saboteurs. An estimate by the director of locomotive service of the line is that about 1,700 of the 45,000 employees were arrested within months. In mid-November, he himself was called to the NKVD and asked how he proposed to end sabotage. As he was unable to think of any cases of sabotage, the line being an exceptionally efficient one, he was bitterly harangued and during the next wave of arrests was pulled in, on December 2, 1937, without a warrant or charge. His wife and 6-year-old son were thrown out of his house 2 days after his arrest, and he was subjected to severe interrogation, with beatings, together with a number of other prisoners, including several station masters and the deputy head of the line. Special railwaymen's prisons were set up in small towns like Poltava. Arrested railwaymen were kept in coaches in unused sidings. Special military courts traveled around the country dealing with them. They were almost invariably Japanese spies. The reason for this was that the Soviet Union had in 1935 handed over the Chinese Eastern Railway to the Japanese. The Russian railwaymen who had operated it and who now returned to the Soviet Union were almost the only non-diplomatic Soviet personnel who had been living abroad, and on their return they were automatically high-grade suspects. With their families, they are said to have numbered about 40,000, and they had meanwhile worked on all the railway systems and recruited their colleagues. Interrogation. Whether soldier or intellectual, Ukrainian or engineer, the arrested man might thus deduce or learn from his acquaintances what the exact charge would be. And this was important. For when he went to interrogation, it was NKVD practice not to tell him what he was in for, but to let him frame his own confession, unless he proved obstinate after a few interrogations, when he might be enlightened. Article 128 of the Code of Criminal Procedure of the RSFSR laid down that the charge against a person under investigation must be presented not later than 48 hours after his arrest. This procedure was not observed. In fact, it contradicted the basic NKVD method. In many cases, charges were not presented until months or years afterward, and in some cases, not at all. Sometimes there were special preliminaries. The Hungarian communist writer Josef Lengyel describes being taken from the ordinary cell in which 275 men lit on, between and under 25 iron bedsteads, to a much worse one for a fortnight softening up prior to interrogation. In this hermetically closed space in the moist heat from human beings and radiators, bread fresh in the morning was white with mold by midday. Some of his cellmates had strokes, and some went insane. Although Lengyel only got jaundice and open sores on arms and legs, his former cellmates did not. 171. Recognize him when he was returned to the ordinary prison. A woman teacher held in solitary confinement in darkness for 40 days to confess her espionage motive in approaching the British consulate for a visa also returned to her cell quite unrecognizable. Worse was the kennel at the Lubyanka, described by the critic, Vinov Razumnik, a true black hole with 60 men packed into a heated basement cell about 15 feet square, with no ventilation but the slit under the door, for a week or even more. Eczema, nausea, and palpitations were universal. This was a variation on the old steam room technique used by the Ogpu in the 1920s. A Soviet writer describes also the standing cell, where, in darkness, a prisoner had room only to stand with his hands at his side, virtually immured. A secretary of the Tatar Provincial Committee was held thus for 2 days and taken out unconscious. Interrogation took place mainly at night. A warder would enter a mess cell and murmur the initial letter of a man's name, upon which those this fitted would give their names until the right man answered. He would then be taken out. All accounts of experiences in the great prisons mention that when escorting prisoners along corridors to interrogation or for other purposes, the warders continually made a clicking sound with their tongues or with their belt buckles, so that others on similar errands would know in advance. The purpose of this, evidently a definite regulation, was to stop anyone from recognizing prisoners from other cells. If two prisoners were about to meet in a corridor, one had his face to the wall while the other went by. In the Boudica yard, which sometimes had to be crossed, were little sentry box style sheds, into which one or the other of two passing prisoners could be shunted. Eventually, down the stairs ringed with anti-suicide nets, the prisoner would arrive at the office of the interrogator, where he might, for the moment, be fairly politely received. The routine questions started, "Do you know where you are? You are in the heart of Soviet intelligence, why do you think you are here?" A confession was now required. In the case of the ordinary prisoner, preparation for public trial did not arise, and the confession was merely a horrible formality required under NKVD custom to justify a sentence which was usually ready for issue. That is, as far as the accused himself was concerned. For interrogation had one further purpose: the implication of hitherto unnamed accomplices. The interrogation technique almost invariably started, not with an accusation, but with the question, "Will you tell me what hypothesis you have formed of the reason for your arrest?" This is said to have been based on a questionnaire used by the Holy Inquisition. The Azhov method, as NKVD officers called it, threw the task of building the case against him on the arrested man. If the accused simply gave an innocent account of everything he had done, tougher methods were used, but it still remained up to the victim to find the right line of confession. Prisoners, with the more or less obvious connivance of the authorities, became expert in helping the newly arrested to devise suitable and satisfactory confessions, thus saving everybody trouble, on both sides. They were various tricks of interrogation. The interrogator might be polite and speak rather in sorrow, and then change to abuse. The obscene cursing of the interrogated was routine. In some cases, it had its effect. In others, not. Weisberg recounts that he found it quite interesting. Many NKVD interrogators were often aware of the complete falsehood of the charges, and some of them would even admit it. Most, however, even though not crediting the full details, professed to believe that they contained a grain of truth, and this sufficed to justify their actions in their own eyes. This applied particularly to the earlier generation of NKVD men. After they themselves were liquidated, the newer intake were much simpler Stalinists, who often seemed to have believed to a great extent in the accused's guilt. For the police machine, too, was ruthlessly purged. We are told that the staff of the Lefortovo prison was wiped out entirely four times. In all, as we have seen, 20,000 NKVD men perished. The turnover of interrogators, as the NKVD itself was purged, was good for the morale of resisting prisoners. To mention that each of the present writers outlasted more than 10 of his examining magistrates, one of them outlasted more than a dozen. In both instances, this included the magistrate who ordered the arrest. In Chelyabinsk, one prisoner was saved from execution when the head of the provincial NKVD angrily exclaimed, "The investigation was conducted by enemies of the people. Now we've got to start all over again." NKVD officers under arrest were usually interrogated more severely than others. They were more pessimistic about the outcome, and were extremely stubborn and reluctant to confess, for they knew what lay ahead of them. They are reported as highly nervous, expecting to be taken out and executed at any moment. We have already dealt with the basic techniques of interrogation. In run-of-the-mill cases, the conveyor remained at first the main system, punctuated by physical assault. A typical case is that of the young secretary of a factory director arrested as one of a Trotskyite sabotage ring. She was kept standing for 2 days with short interruptions and then half-throttled by the examiner until she signed a confession which enabled the NKVD to arrest her chief and the 30-odd other members of the factory's sabotage. 185. Group. The conveyor would break down almost anyone in 4 to 6 days, and most people in 2. Its single disadvantage was that it consumed time and energy. There came a point when the arrests outpaced the interrogative capacity of the NKVD, and the simpler method of beating became routine, under the rubric simplified interrogation procedures. We can date this change precisely. It was on 17 August 18, 1937. In Moscow, Kharkov, and elsewhere, it suddenly came into force. At the Kolodnaya Gora prison interrogation section, a prisoner describes having to stuff his ears with bread to get any sleep that night on account of the shrieking of women being 187. Beaten. In Kazan jail, the first victim was the wife of the premier of the Tatarsk. In the Boudica that summer, One floor of a whole wing of one of the prison buildings was set aside for night interrogation. From 11 p.m. until 3 a.m., the inmates of nearby women's cells were kept awake. Over the screams of the tortured, we could hear the shouts and curses of the torturers. A woman would go half mad thinking that she recognized her. 189. Husband screams. The appearance of mere local initiative was preserved. The weapons were almost always boots, fists, and table legs. But Stalin and Yazhov no longer needed to heed